Mom, we have to talk.
What is it, Cleon?
Kyone.
Isn't that what I said?
There's something about me that I want to share with you because I love you so much, and I want you to know me fully. So, I've been questioning my orientation for a long time now.
Good for you, dear. Gosh, I missed the first 2 minutes of Honey Boo Boo, but it was worth it to have this talk.
No, that wasn't the talk. Mom, I've come to the conclusion that this was so much easier when I practiced it on my own. I'm right-handed, Mom.
We've been thinking that for a long time. Just the other day, your father said, you know, little Kilgallen hasn't gotten the soup spoon up to her mouth without spilling in a pig's age.
It's Kyone.
But you can still give us left-handed grandchildren. We'll have you artificially inseminated by C.C. Sabathia.
Ugh, I just threw up in the back of my mouth.
Here's the important thing. Your father and I don't love you any less, even if you are a hideous freak. Oh, look, it's a rerun of the Mud Pit episode. I loved that one.
Well, that didn't go exactly the way I'd hoped, but today we look behind the myths about left-handers. And now he thinks of it as just one other way he's like Tippi Hedren, Colin McEnroe.
There are so many ways I'm like Tippi Hedren. This is just one of them. She's absolutely right. I'm left-handed. Betsy Kaplan, whom you heard on that introduction, is left-handed. And Patrick Scahill is left-handed. But Kyone Wolfe, who is in some ways the most prototypical left-hander among us, just isn't, which means probably that a lot of our ideas and folklore about left-handers, they may not be all that accurate. I do think that intellect and personality are incredibly complex things. But we actually have some people capable of applying some science as opposed to my guesswork at it. I want to introduce you to Dr. Brendan Calori. He's the director of epilepsy and functional neurosurgery at Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. He's here with me in studio and also joining us by phone. I think that's him up there on the board. Is that him up there on the board? David Woolman is a contributing editor at Wired and the author of A Left Hand Turn Around the World, Chasing the Mystery and Meaning of All Things Southpaw. And also, most recently, The End of Money, which I think has nothing to do with being left-handed. But anyway, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Brendan Calori. So I'm left-handed. First of all, if I were unfortunate enough to be having brain surgery and you kind of had my head open and were looking at my brain, would you be able to tell, just looking at my brain, that I'm left-handed?
Not just looking at your brain. The structure in the brain is essentially symmetric. In fact, radiologists are taught to look at the brain and their eyes are drawn to asymmetry. But we have newer tools now that help us to distinguish where function in the brain lies.
Do you know why I'm left-handed? I mean, does science know why any person is left-handed?
We're beginning to understand better. I think it's a complicated issue. There's no simple answer to that. But there is a genetic predisposition to be right or left-handed. And there was a recent study out of the UK just last month, in fact, that was looking at one specific gene in dyslexic people and found that there was a tendency to have more right-handedness with the more mutations that were found in this gene. But they looked at the general population as well, and there's a whole family of genes that are involved. It's not a single gene that determines this. And it's interesting, the class of genes that determines asymmetry in the body at large, so the fact that your heart is on the left, your stomach's on the left, but your appendix and liver are on the right, there's a family of genes that determines that type of symmetry in the body that is also likely involved in handedness.
David Woolman, I know that you've asked yourself the same question and asked people the same question. Why am I left-handed? Why are you left-handed? Do you now feel as though you have a satisfactory, workable answer to that? Why are you left-handed?
I would say I have an answer that rates at like a B, D plus so far. And, you know, this is one of these remarkable things about our species and about human behavior. It's a very obvious front and center, in-your-face difference between some people and others. You know, I use the left hand to chop vegetables and throw a baseball, et cetera, and someone else uses the right. And yet you can't open up the brain and just see why this is the case right away. But as the doctor was saying, it's there's a genetic explanation that is the leading candidate right now, but there isn't a single gene. This isn't something that breeds true like other traits. And so the best answer has to do with this gene that confers the chance to become left-handed. In other words, if you don't get the gene, you're going to be right-handed. And if you do get the gene, you will also be right-handed unless you roll the dice and you end up with snake eyes. Then you become left-handed.
All right. So that was very complicated, but I think I understood it. So looking at that then, Dr. Brendan Calori, there's sort of terms that we use that I think we kind of use them interchangeably, and I don't think they actually are based on what I've read in David's book and what you've said too. We talk about handedness and we talk about brain dominance, but those are not the same thing, right? I mean, I always assume that if I'm left-handed, that means I have right brain dominance.
Yeah, that's interesting because, I mean, dominance, there are different types of dominance, but the most classic interpretation of that is language dominance. And as a neurosurgeon, I'm very interested in that because so much of who we are as people is related to our ability to talk and understand language. So if I'm going to go in and remove a brain tumor, I have to have a good sense of where that critical structure lies and where its function lies. So typically, language is found in the left hemisphere, and that's true in over 95% of right-handed people, and it's true in the majority of left-handed people as well, somewhere between 60 to 70%. But we find that in left-handed people, there's a higher percentage of right brain dominance and even bi-dominance, where there's language preserved on in both hemispheres. And we've known this for a while, but we've become more and more sophisticated in our way of looking at this and understanding in less invasive ways where these functional areas in the brain live in individuals.
You know, David Woolman, one of the things that you struggled to do in your book is kind of separate out the actual science from the kind of folklore and wild surmise that kind of goes into all this. For example, there is obviously in everything that he just suggested and things that we will go on to say, a connection between speech and handedness. And I personally plead guilty to having engaged in all kinds of wild conjecture. For example, Casey Stengel, who had kind of a mangled syntax, was said to have been one of those left-handers who was forced by teachers and parents and nuns and God knows who else to become right-handed. You know, George H.W. Bush, who kind of also did strange things with language and syntax, was a left-hander. And so I started to develop this theory that maybe if you're left-handed, that actually does something to your speech or makes you a little bit more prone in the kinds of rolls of the dice that you were just talking about to have some problems with language and syntax. But I'm going to ask both of you about this. But David Woolman, start us out. What did you discover about the actual real connection between speech, which seems to be located on that left side of the brain in that Broca's brain area, and handedness?
Well, you know, before diving into speech specifically, I mean, you're speaking to a broader question, you know, and this is the separating the mythology and pseudoscience from the science, and it goes beyond speech to this. You know, I think the most simplistic version is that you know, all left-handers are going to become musicians and artists because they quote unquote think with the right side of the brain, and all right-handers are destined to be you know, more stereotypically boring professionals in accounting or lawyers or something like that, and because they quote unquote think with the left side of the brain. And you know, that's just complete garbage. It's not how the brain works. It's not how humans work. It's certainly not how creativity works. However, and essentially my whole book is trying to pursue this however, this asterisk. You know, there are some substantive differences with how the brains of left-handers work, and that is, number one, fascinating and mysterious, and number two, the question is, well, how, if at all, does that influence how we act and how we think and how we talk? And, you know, this initial issue of where language is located is where it all started. We had Broca discover that he had this patient who had a brain injury and he couldn't talk. And then after this guy died, he opened up his brain and he saw one side of the brain was severely damaged. So he made this connection between the right side of the body and the left side of the brain. And okay, language should be up there. And so for lefties, it should be just the opposite. Speech should be headquartered in the right side of the brain. And the problem is it just doesn't pan out. Lefties also have speech more often located in the left side of the brain, but lefties a little bit more often can be this exception, can have speech headquartered in the right side of the brain. So then again, you run into this puzzle of, well, what does that say about us and how we talk and who we are? And the reality is, I think, you know, things are just more nuanced than that. People's behavior and the way they talk is not going to be determined by something as simplistic as where speech is headquartered in the brain. But the fact that lefties seem to deploy or employ both sides of the brain a little bit more often than right-handers do, that I think in future research is gonna illuminate, you know, where these differences are, or if they're profound at all. You know, if being a lefty really does make you that much more articulate than some other radio hosts. And I'm not going to go so far out on a limb as to say that's the case, but I would love to think it is because I'm a self-taught, too.
Right. I even sort of was prepared to extrapolate from there to the fact that Harpo Marx, the one silent Marx brother, is left-handed, as was Marcel Marceau. No one has ever ascribed eloquence to me based on my handedness or anything else, but thanks for that idea anyway. Well, Dr. Galori, one way we might know some of what David is talking about is to look at people who suffer strokes, right? Because strokes often affect one side more than the other side. Does that tell us anything, what happens to people, left-handed people versus right-handed people or anything like that when they have strokes?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and David made a good point. I mean, historically, the way we learned about the brain and how it functions is when something went wrong and it was kind of postmortem, looking and seeing if there was an injury in Broca's area, which is the part of the brain where speech is manufactured and more. That was the classic understanding. It's a little more complicated than that. It's more the nuts and bolts of speech, whereas Wernicke's area, which is also in the left hemisphere, is comprehending speech. And obviously, Dr. Wernicke was instrumental in discovering that. So historically, that's been how we've learned about the brain with strokes or brain trauma. But fortunately, now we have ways of doing it in a real time and much less invasive. So techniques like functional MRI is a study whereby we can see what part of the brain is activated in a positive way. So when you're tapping your finger, your contralateral motor area for your finger lights up. So your left finger will be your right frontal lobe and the precentral gyrus. And we can do the same thing with more complicated things like reading or remembering. So that's a way of looking at the positive areas in the brain involved as opposed to when something goes wrong. We still do anesthetize parts of the brain, both there's something called a WADA test, which is a really surreal experience for patients where we're trying to localize function in the brain. We actually go into the brain through a catheter in the groin in the vascular system, and we can anesthetize an entire hemisphere or certain areas in the brain and see and simulate a stroke and see what functions are preserved. And we do that even more dramatically in surgery, where we actually can do an awake craniotomy and map out different areas in the brain. And that's a lot of fascinating information's come out of that, because you can be millimeter precise with that as opposed to a stroke, which is a lot less precise, obviously. So you can find out where different languages are represented within Broca's area as opposed to just a gross language dominance left versus right. So
I can see this is going to be one of these Betsy Kaplan produced shows where I'm going to have to put my head between my knees a couple of times. But no, actually, everything you're talking about rings incredibly true. And in fact, Radiolab just did a thing where they were talking to a guy who had had a series of brain operations and was musical. And the surgeons were concerned as they removed material that they didn't want to hurt the musical part of him if possible. And so they kind of tested that. They had him, I think, awake also for the kind of procedure you're talking about, and were kind of testing his musical ability as they went into different areas and stuff so they didn't damage it. So it's I guess you don't have to wait for somebody to have a stroke to learn about these things now. That was a primitive question. Well, we're going to talk about so many aspects of left-handedness today and handedness in general. We'd love to hear from you. If you have questions, we have two experts here. 860-275-7266. If you're listening here in the afternoon, we're live. We can take calls. 860-275-7266. I'm just repeating it for the right-handers. The left-handers got it the first time. All right. So, and you may tweet us, as people have been doing, at WNPR Colin. Love to hear from you that way as well. I should tell you, towards the end of the show, we're not going to talk too much about sports here in the early going. At the end of the show, we're going to talk to two athletes, one baseball player, one basketball player, about what handedness means in their sports. So that'll be, as I say, towards the end of that show. But, one of the things that you, David Woolman, explore in your book is sort of the whole area of kind of prejudice one way or another. On the one hand, left-handed people do have this notion of their own superiority, and we always sort of say, our artist is Michelangelo, who's your artist, that kind of thing. And our scientist is Einstein, who's your scientist. So on the other hand, most of us did grow up with teachers kind of frowning at us when we asked in an Oliver Twistian way if we could have a different kind of scissors. You're one of those, and you're going to have bad penmanship and all this kind of stuff. Let's hear how that played out on our favorite source of TV material, Seinfeld.
Because when you're left-handed, you put down for being left-handed. You know, it's always left. Oh, left words are always negative things. Leftovers. They're terrible. Two left feet, left-handed compliment. You ever see a crook named Righty? You never see that. Everything right is a positive thing. Right on, the Bill of Rights. You go to a party, there's nobody there. Where'd everybody go? They left.
All right, so so David Wolman, this is something you deal with in your book. Is there's both a cachet and a stigma, but talk about the stigma.
Sure. Well, the stigma has a much more historical heft to it than the cachet, because really it's through the ages and across cultures all around the globe, left-handedness has been looked down upon, and if not something to hide and quickly correct. And there's the strong linguistic connection between left and evil and sinister and left-handed compliment, et cetera. And then there's just the behavioral one. And this really is, it's an unfortunate human tradition. We look at someone who's a little bit different and think that they're a problem or wrong or defective in some way. And, in Japanese language, an idiom to deploy maybe is that the nail that sticks up a little gets hammered down. And so left-handers were sticking out or being noticeable in a way that was unacceptable. Any part of the world, from the mountains of the Himalayas, where people are sort of eating with one hand and doing other things related to hygiene with the other hand, to Victorian England, to South America, all around the world, I was sort of exploring this question of why was left-handedness looked down upon for so long. But as you say, in recent years, there's been this this turn, at least in more developed countries, where people are seeing that it's not something that needs to be swiftly corrected, and that maybe it's even kind of cool. And in a way, it's sort of a positive consequence of the pseudoscience garbage that lefties, quote unquote, think in the right side of the brain and are therefore more creative, because we put so much currency in the idea of creativity. But of course, the fact is that's not how lefties think, and that's not what makes them creative if they are creative. But nevertheless, they are a little different. And like anything now, if people are a little bit different, that adds to the diversity that makes our society wonderful and isn't something that should be, remedied ASAP.
You know, let me just ask you a question. I want you to forget, David Wolman, that you've talked to all these scientists, and I want you to forget that Dr. Brendan Calori is sitting here listening to you. If you meet somebody and talk to them for 1 or 2 minutes without watching them use a pen or pencil or, whatever, do you feel like you probably can take a guess at whether they're left-handed or not?
No, okay. No. However, when I see a waiter or a barista or anybody taking notes, and they show that they're left-handed, I sense this kind of, as ridiculous as this might sound, this kind of instant kinship with that person. And it's fun and it's lighthearted, but it's also not completely trivial. We've sort of been through the same things, and I don't mean like super hardships per se, that we share this fun difference. We are, kind of this team, this minority group, and I like that sense of connection. There's, and a kind of extreme example is a gentleman that I profiled in my book who lives in Illinois, and he went through this horrible accident, and you have to keep up with the left and right here, but you can do it. He was actually struck by a train, and he lost his left arm at the shoulder. But it was a clean separation. He also lost his right hand. It was completely destroyed. And so because the paramedics got the left arm on ice very quickly, the doctors were able to reattach his left hand. They sort of salvaged the left hand from the orphaned left arm and put it on his right wrist because he was a righty. And he now has, not function like you and I have, but he has a lot of function. He has his left hand sewn onto his right wrist. This guy named John Evans is a wonderful man who I met a couple of years ago and wrote about. And, so we talked a lot about what does it mean to be this kind of honorary member of the fraternity of Southpaw. And, he said he couldn't be more grateful. Of course, he's also just grateful that he was patched together again as well as he was. But he said, I do feel like I'm sort of part of this group that I wasn't connected to before.
The main thing that I learned from that story in your book was if your foot is caught in the railroad tracks, take your shoe off, you know, which he apparently didn't do. But, I mean, a more pedestrian example of that, and just to sort of bring up kind of how this kind of plays out in the news and in history. I mean, in 1992, there were three candidates for president. They were all left-handed, H. Ross Perot, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush. In 1996, it was the same thing, although Bob Dole was a little bit more in the category of your John Evans. He was sort of an honorary left-hander as opposed to born that way. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, you use the phrase, I think, sort of a fun distinction, a fun difference. But as we know, it isn't always the case. And I wanted to, actually, Dr. Calori told me something before we went on the air that I want to go to for a second. It's kind of funny because this morning I had to go and have my tooth looked at. I had a tooth removed about a week and a half ago, and they were just rechecking it. And the oral surgeon walked in. He's the guy who had done it the last time. And I looked at him, and I thought, I have a funny feeling he's left-handed. And he picked up an instrument, and he definitely was left-handed. But Dr. Calori, you were saying, actually, for surgeons being left-handed, that's an issue right there. And it may be fun, but it's expensive, right?
No, absolutely, because just, I mean, as a child, any left-hander knows that this you got to use a different pair of scissors, and scissors go for $1.99 or so at the local market. But when it comes to surgical instruments, obviously, those are a lot more expensive, and the majority of instruments will not open in your hand if you're left-handed. So I have lots of friends who've, especially in training, you're asking, a hospital has to purchase sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of instruments for someone that's just only going to be there for a few years in training. So it definitely presents a challenge. But definitely in surgery, ambidexterity is prized. So you're ultimately using both your hands as much as possible.
And you kind of are that guy, right?
Well, my grandfather was ambidextrous, and I grew up, you know, I do write with my right hand predominantly. I'm a minority today in the program, but drawing with both hands, I inverted my letters a lot, so my mother gently encouraged me to use one hand or the other. There was no knuckle wrapping with a ruler, and ultimately that was my right hand. But in surgery, it definitely helps that I'm comfortable using my left hand as well. There are certain types of brain surgeries where you need to clip an aneurysm or something using your left hand, and that makes it a little easier, I think.
Yeah, I'm definitely having you do my brain surgery. Why would I want somebody who can only use one hand? I want the best there is. But David Woolman, that brings up an interesting thing from your book, which is, you know, we say left-handed, we say right-handed, as though those were ironclad distinctions. I know you looked at this kind of Edinburgh classification system, I think it is. I mean, it isn't necessarily – it's more you score a certain, you know, high or low score on a certain kind of handedness, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have sort of a cultural shorthand for determining if someone is lefty or righty. No pun intended with shorthand there. But, you know, the quick hit version, almost always, I think at least, is what hand is someone riding with, and then maybe we look at throwing, and then you sort of go down this chain of different activities or behaviors, from chopping vegetables or brushing your teeth or combing your hair, et cetera. And, you know, one of the big things that plays out in this discussion of handedness is that, like a lot of things, when we even say, okay, well, someone is left-handed or right-handed, what does that even mean? And it turns out it's much more of a sliding scale situation, and that the language that I'm hearing more scientists turn to is saying someone is, quote-unquote, strong-handed or mixed-handed. So I'm a strong left-hander, and what that means is I do pretty much any function where you're using one hand or the other, I use the left hand. But maybe my neighbor down the street, or maybe you, Colin, are left-handed, but you're more of a mixed-hander because you happen to chop onions and brush your teeth and, you know, prefer to drive a car this way or that. And so you're more in the mixed-handed category. And
how dare you?
And, exactly. Or maybe, and again, you know,
I'm not totally left-handed.
Not assigning.
Although, let me ask you a question, because it's when Dr. Brendan Calori asked me. When you talk on your phone, which ear do you hold it to?
You're asking me, David?
I'm asking you, David Woolman, yeah.
Yeah, I go to the left ear, but I kick with the right foot, so I'm right foot dominant. Hmm. And, you know, you can start to go down. Then it gets really peculiar, because now people have, they're not just mixed-handed with with their preferences, they have this mixed laterality, so right-footed, left-handed. And, you know, most people, when we say ambidextrous, we're actually using it incorrectly, because we look at a four-year-old wondering if he's going to be a lefty or righty, and the parent will say, oh, he's really ambidextrous. He's doing a lot of different tasks with either hand. And so the reality is that just because your kid is eating breakfast here with the left hand but writing with the right hand, that's not ambidextrous. Ambidextrous, in the more technical sense, is that you can do any activity just as well with either hand. And in fact, finding people like that is very, very hard, because if you give people enough tests, they're going to be able to find something they can't do equally well with both hands.
All right, we're going to take a break here. I do want to say that if you're left-footed, which I am also left-footed, it doesn't give you any real advantage in sports, except that it creates opportunities to do things that you have no business doing. And Dr. Brendan Caloria and I both were at Davenport College at Yale University, and even though I am slow, I was the left wing on the Davenport College soccer team for one season, simply because I could cross the ball with my left foot. All right, so anyway, just another reason, Doctor. If I fall over here at any point, I want Dr. Brendan Caloria to be my neurosurgeon. I'm saying this. I'm making all of you who work here, my healthcare advocate on that. He can operate with both hands, and he went to Davenport College. All right, we're going to take a little break. We got a lot of phone calls here. We got tweets coming in, and we'll try to deal with all those things when we come back.
I wish I was left-handed, 'cause I'm running around with two left hands.
Do you think left-handed people are different than right-handed people?
I think they're smarter.
Smarter?
Yeah.
Yeah, most left-handed people I know are shorter than me, so.
No, I think it looks a little strange when they write. My mom's left-handed, but other than that, I think they're all the same.
They actually might be a little more creative because it's a right-handed world. So left-handed people may be better than right-handed people.
I don't see how that can be true, though.
Okay.
All right. Those are words from the street collected, no doubt, by one of our fine interns, but I don't know who. Somebody really good, though, definitely. All right. We're talking about handedness today. Our guests are David Woolman. His book is A Left-Hand Turn Around the World, Chasing the Mystery and Meaning of All Things Southpaw. And Dr. Brendan Caloria, he's the director of epilepsy and functional neurosurgery at Hartford Healthcare Medical Group. We're happy to hear from you. We've got some people calling in at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. David Woolman, one of the things that this book makes clear is that you're very smart about figuring out really cool places that you can go while you're working on your book. And so you found all. But one of the things that you did investigate, and obviously got a great trip out of it too, was the whole question of left-handers as warriors. We should say we won't have time to cover everything David did in his book, ranging from a left-handed golf tournament in Asia to actually finding out about left-handed sword fighters and warriors. So initially, David, one of the theories was that, and it might even explain why there weren't as many left-handers back before we had access to some of the kinds of sophisticated scientific judgments that we have now, is that maybe they weren't that good in the days of swords and shields because of where they held the sword and therefore where they put the shield.
Right, and as you said, it's one of so many
crackpot.
Short and sweet, but ultimately crackpot theories as to why left-handers are still a minority in the population. And, you know, we circle back to this genetic explanation, but you're right. I mean, it's just an elegant explanation, because with the arm outstretched with the sword and the shield held in your right hand, you know, now your heart is more exposed to an oncoming sword or dagger than if you were a right-hander positioned in an opposite manner. And that's kind of cool and interesting, but the reason I got further interested in this question of sword fighting for the book is because I think it's a useful entree into this conversation about the genetics question, because through the ages, there are a lot of people with the last name Kerr, K-E-R-R, or various spellings thereof, who were left-handed or claimed to have left-handers in their family or were certain that there were more left-handers in their family than some other family, et cetera. And so the idea traces back to this family and this castle in Scotland. And so I went there because the staircases inside this castle all spiral the opposite way that most other staircases spiral. And to be honest, I can't remember if it's clockwise or counterclockwise right now. But the reason was because there were a lot of people in the Kerr clan who were left-handed, and they positioned the stairwell in a way that as they defended the castle, as they were backing up the stairs, they wouldn't be impeded by the walls of the spiraling staircase. And so this gave them, apparently or allegedly, an advantage over their enemies when defending the castle. And this opens up the conversation again about, okay, can we use people whose last name is Kerr today to examine this question of whether handedness is, you know, sort of a nature or nurture question. Is there a gene? Can we hunt for this gene in people who come from that family? And it turns out we can't necessarily, but it sure made for a cool trip and a fun way to introduce the idea.
And also a fun way to trigger, of course, another reminiscence, which is, of course, the scene in both the book and the movie The Princess Bride, in which Inigo Montoya decides, because most of the swordsmen that he fights are so inferior to him, that he will fight the man in black left-handed. Then he discovers that the man in black himself is also left-handed, so they're both fighting one another left-handed. And, of course, here's what happens.
You are wonderful.
Thank you. I've worked hard to become so.
I admit it, you are better than I am.
Then why are you smiling?
Because I know something you don't know.
And what is that?
I am not left-handed.
You're amazing.
I ought to be after 20 years.
Oh, there's something I ought to tell you.
Tell me. I'm not left-handed either.
It's a great moment. They both eventually, of course, switch to their right hands and then have a whole other sword fight. And so we're going to go to the phones here just for a second. We're talking about handedness. This looks like a Dr. Brendan Calori question from Anna in Andover. Hi, Anna.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's in your mind?
Well, I just was wondering if there was a lower incidence of dementia in left-handed people. I know it's not a...
What would make you think that, just out of curiosity?
What was what?
What would make you think that?
Well, my father came from a family of five children.
Mm-hmm.
The three left-handers did not get dementia. The two right-handers did.
Good enough for me. Sounds like a scientific fact. No, I'm just kidding. But it's a great question, actually. So I don't know whether you have those statistics at your fingertips, Dr. Brendan Calori, but there probably is at least some scientific basis for thinking about this.
That's a great question. You know, I'm not aware of a study that's pointed to that, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. And I think we have if nothing else, your family could maybe write that up and we could publish that. That's a fascinating. And it makes sense. I mean, the most recent data on dementia shows that exercising the body and the mind is a good way to hold off the symptoms. And you can imagine if the right and left brain have to talk to each other more because of, you know, bilateral speech representation and motor representation that could involve more activation in the brain. I mean, I'm really this is just entirely speculating on my part, and there very well might be data that I'm not aware of, but it's an interesting observation. It wouldn't surprise me if there were some basis.
Well, it is interesting. It's a really interesting question. Anna, thank you so much for it, too. But as long as we're doing this, and obviously there's no way that you can give us a neurological education here in the next 3 minutes. But, you know, one of the things that even people who don't know anything about it, one of the terms they're thinking of right now, a certain number of people, is the corpus callosum, this whole idea that there's a bundle of nerves that communicates between the hemispheres. So in terms of handedness, in terms of brain dominance, all the things that we've been talking about so far today, is there any significant difference that way? I mean, one might think that left-handers might have a more developed bundle of nerves since they're having to do different kinds of communication.
Well, actually, the fascinating thing with the corpus callosum, it's a little off topic, but I'm going to use it because it's just something that's always fascinating to me.
Nothing is off topic on this show.
So the corpus callosum, I'm an epilepsy surgeon, and there was a procedure known as a corpus callosotomy whereby people with really debilitating seizures who were falling down and hitting their heads all the time would have an actual disconnection of the left and right brain so that a seizure would just stay on one side and they wouldn't lose consciousness and put themselves at risk for injury. And what was really fascinating is what came out of that, where you essentially have two brains. I mean, there are other connections between the right and the left hemisphere, but the vast majority of the connections are in this corpus callosum. There are subtle things like a person who has language on the left side, for instance, they hold an object in their left hand, wouldn't be able to tell you what that is, whereas they would be able to identify it in their right hand. And that would go true for their visual fields, have trouble reading things on the left side of a page or vice versa if they had right dominant speech. And then there's the really exotic, strange things that happen. There's something called alien hand syndrome, which is a rare variant of this where one hand would not – the patient wouldn't experience it as their own. And you'd actually have patients that would reach with something with their non-dominant hand, and their dominant hand would reach over and smack it like it was another person almost. And you can almost imagine two – people living in one body, and the brain is like that. It's you know, I live every day studying the brain. I'm operating on it, but I'm still just fascinated by some of the things that can happen. The bottom line is we don't understand all the genetic underpinnings or even the neuroscientific connections in the brain. So,
you know, and just worth — we're going to go to a different segment in just a second here, but since you're saying that, I think it's worth pausing on that kind of moment of agnosticism and emphasizing it, because, you know, we headed into this conversation, as David Woolman was saying, with a lot of myths about left-handed people, things that all of us put together, kind of our own network of understanding about what it means to be left-handed or to be right-handed. And you do get sort of things like they think outside the box, they're quirkier, they're more creative, they're more this, they're more that. You're in the business of opening up the skull and looking in at this thing, which is kind of who we are, you know, our intellect, our personality, it's somehow or other contained there. And I would imagine that ultimately the more that you know, the more you realize that our intellect, our personality, the kinds of things we're talking about and ascribing to handedness must be, in fact, the result of all kinds of different complex multipliers, you know, that come out of all kinds of different aspects of the brain. And to attribute quirkiness or creativity to handedness would probably be a pretty sledgehammer way of looking at things.
Yeah, it is oversimplifying things, but you can't deny the, you know, all the fact that since 1974, like you alluded to, that every presidential election has had a left-handed president. I mean, there's some basic common sense type of the data that suggests there's something there. And part of it is probably informed by structural asymmetries in the brain that we're just beginning to unravel. And, you know, I think David is hit the nail on the head. There's a lot more going on. And this is one very gross manifestation of something that's a lot subtler and exists on a spectrum. But then there's always the interplay, the old, you know, nature versus nurture. There's a lot to who we are that we're not born with. And so the way that a left-handed person or a right-handed person or interacts with his or her environment and deals with challenges in life is going to inform a lot on who they are as a person. And I don't like that dichotomy, because as we understand the brain better and better, we see that there's a lot of manifestation in the brain and the connections in the brain that we can now quantify with techniques like functional MRI and cranial magnetic stimulation, where we actually stimulate parts of the brain through the skull and suppress areas that will be altered by things like cognitive behavior therapy and everyday experiences. So to get back to your initial question, I mean, it's to me, I love coming to work, and it fascinates me that I kind of live in this existential realm that's manifest in a very corporeal, physical space, and and we're just beginning to understand it. It's fascinating. And we all experience it. I mean, the brain is something that you right away pick up when something is different or wrong with someone's brain. And we're processing it as humans on so many different levels without even being 100% aware of it. So,
all right. We're going to take a little break here. We haven't touched on the sports part of it. The sports part of it is an undeniably big part of it. So we'll come back with that after this.
I've got a left-handed baby. She rides with her left hand. Left-handed mama. She likes a right-handed man.
Colin, Betsy, and Patrick never let me use a WNPR left-handed chainsaw, but they're not around right now, so let's do this. Okay, I'm gonna need a tourniquet. Right-handed tourniquet, if possible. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Albert Gordon and Garrett Connolly. The part of Bill Curry was played by H. Ross Perot. On tomorrow's show, our salute to all the chemistry teachers who didn't break bad. And now, back to Colin.
A couple quick announcements here. First of all, happy birthday to my son, Joey McEnroe. And second of all, it's kind of the last call for tomorrow's freshly squeezed forum at Watkinson School. This is I encourage you to come to this. It's open to the public. You can find out how to get tickets at watkinson.org, the site of Watkinson School. It's about sort of ethical consumerism, the notion that you want to spend your money in a way that conforms to your ideas about ethics, about values, whether that's workers' rights or animal safety or climate change, whatever. We have a panel that I could not have dreamed that we would be able to have. I mean, really, four really tremendous experts on this. If you listen to the show a lot, you'll recognize Bun Lai, who runs the most sustainable sushi restaurant in the U.S., and Barry Nailbuff, one of the founders of Honest Tea, but also a Yale professor of management, knows a lot about how other corporations handle the whole question of ethics. So if you're interested in this, please join us tomorrow, 7 p.m., Watkinson School. Get on the Watkinson site to find out how to get your tickets. Plus, Patrick and Betsy will be there. We're going to be trying to create a radio show out of this as well. So a lot going on there. All right. So we've got to address the whole question of sports, and it's something David Woolman looks at in his book. And so let's start out with baseball. Baseball is the place where you absolutely cannot deny the fact that left-handers have a very special role to play, particularly when it comes to pitching. So we decided to find a pitcher. Anthony Marzi is a starting pitcher for the UConn Husky men's baseball team. And as the playoffs get underway, Anthony Marzi, a lot of us who are baseball fans will find ourselves sitting on a couch next to somebody who doesn't really follow baseball all that carefully and may not understand, therefore, why in certain situations left-handed pitchers are called in to get one particular batter out. So maybe just for starters, explain what it is about a left-handed pitcher. What advantage does the left-handed pitcher have in a certain situation?
Well, it's pretty simply put that it's just left-handed pitchers are more rare in the sport of baseball and in pitching, of course, so they're more sought after. And, you know, typically when you see a left-handed guy come out of the bullpen, it's to face a left-handed batter because, you know, there's a deception factor there with the left hand and the left-handed batter being at the plate. So, you know, it's kind of harder for that left-handed batter to see the ball coming out of the left hand. And, you know, some people would say, isn't that the same for righty on righty? But since there's more righties in the game, you know, they're more acclimated to seeing that. And it's just the fact that left-handed pitchers are more rare, so they're not as used to it. So I guess that's the role that left-handed pitchers play out of the bullpen for sure.
And so for the left-handed batter, the curveball in particular looks like it's coming right at the left-handed batter.
Especially a slider.
Yeah. So, and hey, David Woolman, I don't know if you explored this or not. I might have missed it in the book, but, you know, he just used the term left-handed batter. This is, I'm left-handed in just about everything that I do, but I hit from the right side of the plate. Did you manage to figure out what left-handed batter, whether that is a term that even makes sense?
No, not really. I mean, this is, as the doctor was saying earlier on, there's this false dichotomy between nature and nurture, and, you know, handedness or laterality or asymmetry, you know, this is a biological phenomenon from the get-go of conception. But as soon as you spring forth into the world, culture or an environment are going to have their sway over what you do, you behave. And one of the clear ways is, you know, when you're first learning how to hold a hockey stick or a baseball bat or a tennis racket, you know, who is instructing you how to do so, and does that person you know, have particular enthusiasm for the left side or the right side, or they want to help you become a lefty batter because they want you to be one step closer to first base, or, you know, I can certainly confess to some bias when it comes to handing my young children a spoon before mealtime.
Well, yeah, my father was
beyond hope that they'll be left-handed. So, you know, this is kind of the cultural layer on top of the biological layer of the mystery of handedness.
A couple more questions for Anthony really quickly. The other advantage that the left-handed pitcher has, obviously, is holding a runner on at first. The right-handed pitcher has his back to first base as he goes into his delivery. You're looking right at that runner, right?
Right.
And so theoretical advantages exist there. Let me ask you about just a couple of the folklore things. So those of us old enough to remember the pitcher Bill Lee or Mark Fidrich, you know, there was this sort of whole idea also that left-handed pitchers are quirkier. They're different. They're not only different just biologically in how they throw, but there's something different about them. Do you buy into that? I know UConn right now has a whole bunch of left-handed pitchers on the staff.
Yeah. You know, there's a big stereotype that left-handed pitchers are the goofy guys on the team, wear their hats differently, usually slanted off to the left. I mean, I can't speak to that because I don't do any of that. But, you know, there are a few lefties on our team that you'll see the slanted hat, and they're more the goofier guys on the team. So I guess there is some truth to it, but you won't find it in me.
All right, mythology then. Thanks so much, Anthony Marzi. We're going to go now to LaChyna Robinson. LaChyna Robinson, an analyst for ESPN. We're going to talk about basketball now. Basketball, it's less obvious anyway. It's not typically the one-on-one kind of sport that obviously left-handers have been kind of dominant in professional bowling. There certainly was a period in tennis where Rod Laver was followed by Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe, just dominant left-handed tennis players. In basketball, LaChyna Robinson, first of all, is there some advantage to being left-handed?
Yeah, no, there definitely is. I mean, first of all, obviously the rarity itself just makes it difficult to defend a left-hander. I think that's number one, because you're expecting them to go right. I mean, most right-handed basketball players, which the majority are, look to drive to the right hand. They're more comfortable making moves to the right. The way you angle your body is just, I think it's more normal to say, obviously I'm left-handed, so I don't think it's normal, but to go from that right side. So it's very difficult for defenders to then change the way that they defend, because actually your top foot defensively is determined by what hand they shoot with. So it's just something that's rare. So that's number one in terms of how to defend a lefty. But the other side of it is I believe that left-handers are better shooters. Now, I don't have the science behind it, but I will say that in studying the sport, both at the professional and the college level, that watching most left-hand shooters, they just have a better technique. And also keeping in mind that if you're going to contest a left-hand shooter, you have to use a different side of your body. So it's just something that's rather awkward and rare, and I think it's an advantage because it is so.
Well, you know, oddly enough, though, in men's basketball anyway, the left-handed players that I think of are our centers. Bill Walton, Bill Russell, Willis Reed, Dave Cowens. Okay, Dave Cowens maybe not quite at the same level as those other guys, but okay, those are three of the greatest centers in NBA history are left-handed. So that's not very much about jump shooting. That's their hook shot. Similarly the kind of unplanned thing. Now, women's basketball, I confess, and I'm ashamed of it, I don't know as much about it. Are left-handers prevalent within professional women's basketball or high-level women's college basketball?
I would say right now the trend is stronger in high-level women's college basketball. Skylar Diggins is a lefty. Odyssey Sims, who's projected to maybe be the number one pick draft pick this season, is a lefty. Alyssa Thomas, who will probably be a top five player from the University of Maryland, is a lefty. Odyssey Sims is from Baylor, obviously. And so we're looking all of a sudden, and there's just this rash of left-handed players that are at the top of women's college basketball. And again, I think I've only read literature on this, but in terms of the artistic inclination and some of the ways that lefties think, the way they see the floor and the strategy of basketball is different. I think it's the way they see things, the side of the floor that they go to. A left-handed basketball player is going to come down the floor, most likely goes to the left side of the floor.
Yeah.
If I'm defending, I'm used to seeing them go to the right side of the floor. So,
maybe an example of that I forgot, somebody just pointed out to me, Betsy just pointed it out to me, Larry Bird, left-hander, and a guy who really did see the floor kind of differently. Although one observation I would say here at the end, being a left-handed person who played a lot of basketball, seems to me usually after two or three trips down the floor, they figure out you're left-handed. They start pushing you right. They start sitting on your left hand. They start blocking your shots. I mean, good basketball players, it seems to me they figure that out after about 30 seconds and your advantage is gone. We have to stop right now. Thank you, LaChyna Robinson. Thank you, Anthony Marzi. I just dropped the mouse on the floor. Dr. Brendan Calori, David Woolman, the author of A Left Hand Turn Around the World. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan, too, for producing this.
and I've got no complaint if you're left-handed, right-handed, left-handed.
I'm Kyone Wolf. How hard could it be, you know, to run this board with my left hand? I mean, it's just knobs and buttons.